Hi friends, my name is Kevin. Welcome to the Via Media podcast. The public debate on abortion is one of the most contentious and divisive topics of public life. The June 2022 United States Supreme Court decision, Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, ruled that, quote, the Constitution does not confer a right to abortion, end quote. This overruled the Roe v. Wade decision of 1975 and the Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania v. Casey decision of 1992. While these decisions have profound impact for public policy, what is missing are the stories of real people that find themselves needing to make complicated decisions regarding their reproductive health. That kind of humanity is glaringly missing in our political discourse and relegates our legal and moralistic positions and beliefs as uninformed and even harmful when we do not consider carefully and sincerely the real lives of those who seek abortions. Regardless of your convictions on abortion, we should all agree that it truly is a complicated choice, and the way forward is for us to understand better and deeper what exactly those complications are and how they manifest in real life. Reverend Katie Zay is an ordained Baptist minister and the chief executive officer of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. Katie is a member of the Clergy Advocacy Board of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, the co-host of the Kindreds podcast, and the author of two books, Women Rise Up, Sacred Stories of Resistance for Today's Revolution, and A Complicated Choice, Making Space for Grief and Healing in the Pro-Choice Movement. The topic of tonight's discussion. Here is my conversation with the Reverend Katie Zay. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Via Media. I'd like to welcome and introduce Reverend Katie Zay. She is the CEO. First of all, she's an ordained Baptist minister, the CEO of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, the author of two incredible books. The first is Rise Up. Oh, sorry. I had the title wrong. Women Rise Up. Sacred Stories of Resistance for Today's Revolution. Incredible explication of the biblical stories of women and different ways and perspectives of understanding their participation in the biblical narrative. And then the book that we're going to talk about today, A Complicated Choice, Making Space for Grief and Healing in the Pro-Choice Movement. Katie, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to Via Media.
Thank you, Kevin. I'm thrilled. I can't wait for this.
All right. So let's start at the very beginning. How can a ordained Baptist minister be the CEO of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice? Give me that story. What is that all about?
I am not the first Baptist minister to be CEO of this organization. I just realized as you were talking, I think the first woman Baptist minister, but not the first. So I am not one of a kind in that way. I mean, where to begin here? I think it disrupts the idea of what it means to be Baptist. I think it disrupts what it means to be a minister. It disrupts what it means to be pro-choice, which is kind of my jam. That's where I have existed for as long as I can remember. And I think it just has to do with my call to ministry and where I feel like I'm supposed to be in this lifetime. That doesn't really make a lot of sense to a lot of people. And there are a whole group of people who go, I am so glad to know that there is a woman Baptist minister doing this work because it's so needed, especially right now.
Yeah, you're definitely breaking a lot of molds. I want to start with some history. Give us a little bit of the background of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, which we will call RCRC from here on out. So give us a little bit of the history of it. And then I want to spend the rest of our time talking about the philosophies that you are advancing, because this is an incredibly unique kind of an organization. Professedly religious, definitely ecumenical and interreligious, multi-faith, but religious nonetheless. And religion is, traditionally and publicly and most popularly known as a pro-life position, political posture. And so what you're doing seems to be very unique. So give us a little bit of the history of RCRC, how it's come about, and what is its place within the public discourse and conversation. And then we'll get to some of the most recent history, Dobbs v. Jackson, of course, and then some of the philosophies that you guys are advocating.
Wonderful. I love talking about this because I think it's actually a short history lesson in American religion and some of the parts that have been forgotten. If we go back to 1967, this is pre-Roe versus Wade, there were clergy starting in New York City who came together because they realized that women in their communities were dying from unsafe abortions. And they felt it was their obligation as faith leaders to make sure that their communities were cared for. And so starting in New York City, there was something called the Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion. And it basically worked as a referral network for anyone who reached out to them and said, you know, I need an abortion, my daughter needs an abortion. They would help connect to reputable providers, you know, either within that area or sometimes outside of the country, connecting people to where they were going to get safe care with dignity. And that actually expanded to 38 states over 6 years, you know, the years leading up to Roe, and approximately 500,000 people were helped by this clergy network. At the time, it was predominantly white Protestant men and Jewish rabbis with some Unitarian Universalist ministers and some lay people, Catholic nuns were part of it as well. But I think it's important to talk just demographically who was part of this because many of them operated with a lot of privilege. So, but all that being said, this network was instrumental, not only making sure people got access to care, but also advocating publicly for the legalization of abortion at the state and national level. And after Roe versus Wade was now the law of the land, communities decided that they needed to make sure that those laws were codified at the state level. And so some of the denominations and faith groups came together to form what was then the Religious Coalition for Abortion Rights in 1973. And then in 1994, we changed our name to the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice to reflect an expanded mission that was more than just abortion care, but all of the things that people need to thrive in their reproductive lives and in their lives in general. So that is who we are. This is our 50th anniversary of this year.
50 years. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's ask, first of all, I think highlighting that history seems to be missing from our current discourse. And amazingly, as most of us would probably not be surprised, we forget that history so quickly. I'm kind of curious how much of that history is part of the work that you do, and how important do you think it is to keep telling that history, given that, at least in modern day public discourse, hardly anybody thinks or remembers or can even consider a Baptist or religious position being such advocates for a, you know, abortion care or reproductive choice or all that kind of stuff?
I always like to explain to people in part kind of how we got here and how that erasure happened and how the dominant narrative became what it is. And I'm not a scholar on this. There are amazing people like Catherine Stewart who have, you know, studied and researched the rise of white Christian nationalism, but that's absolutely why we have the narrative that we do now, which is, you know, to be a Christian means that you are pro-life, no questions asked. That has definitely not always been true. It's always been an issue, just like any other issue where there is a spectrum of opinion and theological belief. You know, going back to 1973, the Southern Baptist Convention actually affirmed the Roe versus Wade decision. They were pro-choice. Reverend Billy Graham was pro-choice. There was an active campaign, political campaign, to convince folks like Reverend Billy Graham to become pro-life for political gain. And I think that that's the part that folks have to understand, no matter what your personal beliefs are about this, that it was always a politically motivated movement to get votes, to you know, get power. And they've done a great job of it. I mean, we see white Christian nationalism doing quite well in terms of their platform and how they've managed to amass power. And we see that it goes well beyond just abortion rights specifically and impacts all kinds of communities. All of us are impacted by their political agenda that they've been working toward for 50 years to get us where we are now.
Yeah. I know this question might be a little bit redundant, but I feel like it's incredibly important to highlight the reason why the religious sector was advocating for a pro-choice ethic was because, and you fill in the blank. Like, I feel like this is really critical. You mentioned it at the beginning, but this I feel like needs to be highlighted because there's a fundamental religious ethic that's underlying why so many religious folks, dedicated Christians, were part of this movement.
Because it was integral to their care of their communities. I mean, these religious folks saw the impact that illegal abortion was having, not just on people in general, but poor folks, Black folks, people who were already marginalized and unable to get access to care. They were the ones being impacted by the fact that abortion was illegal. And so for them, it was very much part of their conviction that they care for the people in their communities. And that meant making sure that they had access to quality health care, including reproductive health care and abortion access specifically. For them, there was no question about that, even as they left room for nuanced conversations around, you know, the value of fetal life and things like that, right? It was a crisis. It was an emergency, very much like the one that we're in now. And for these dedicated people of faith, there was no question but to take action at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let's get into some of those. Thank you for that. I think that's really, really important to highlight. You start in your preface on page 21, XXI. I am no longer interested in circular conversations regarding the moral absolutes of abortion. What I am fully invested in is working to dismantle abortion stigma within myself, in the church, and in the world, so that we can start showing up fully and lovingly for the people in our communities who have abortions. What is abortion stigma?
To put it very briefly, it's the ick factor that most of us have when we hear the word abortion, when we think about abortion. There is almost an ingrained response of like, ugh, like a punch to the gut. Ooh, I don't really want to talk about that. And what it is it's this manufactured idea by white Christian nationalism that abortion is wrong, bad, something to be avoided at all costs. And I would say no matter what your political beliefs are, if you grew up with a religious tradition or not, if that religious tradition was pro-choice or not, we all have it. It is ingrained in this culture, just like sexism and racism and heterosexism and classism. I mean, and honestly, a lot of those things are at play with abortion specifically. Yeah. And so it functions very much to, you know, to keep us quiet about this issue, to have snap judgments about people who have abortions, maybe to not be super involved in making sure that people get access to abortion care. It functions to silence and to stigmatize especially people who need access to abortion care or who have had access to abortion care in the past.
Yeah. So this gets into the really difficult philosophical and emotional postures that people have regarding this, because a position of pro-choice what words to even use to describe, because all of this seems just so much like a powder keg. On the extreme can... like it's so much like this celebration and this great thing that you're doing and, you know, personal empowerment. And then on the pro-life side, it's murder and it's there's no compromise. Life starts here. And what you've done in that explanation is talk about a much more complicated kind of pervasive view of this issue that is that involves messaging, beliefs, postures, etc. And so part of what the work that you've done here is to say you want to make space for grief and healing in the pro-choice movement and try to tackle and take care of, you know, abortion stigma. I mean, how do you do that in the midst of the vitriolic kind of polarized absolute arguments that are happening? What's your strategy?
For me, it was talking to people. I mean, it was talking to people who had experienced abortions in their lives. I'm not someone who has needed an abortion to this point. So I don't speak from a personal abortion story perspective. However, I have spent much of my life, you know, journeying alongside people either during their abortions at the in the moment or talking with them afterward. And so that's really been integral to my ministry and honestly keeps me very grounded and centered in this because abortion is never abstract. And I think what the debate does is it makes it seem like it's this nebulous concept that happens out there, not in my community, not in my family, not in my church. And it's much easier to become very judgmental of others when you feel like it's not something that has directly impacted you in any sort of way, or you don't know anyone, anybody. So the quickest way for me to address judgment is to start talking with people or reading stories of people who have experienced abortions. And that's really what this book is about, is showcasing, highlighting very individual stories that often point to systemic issues that contribute to a very anti-life society that we live in. You know, and we can get more into what that means, but, you know, pro-choice is not even a great frame. I mean, it's a common frame that people use, but sometimes people really don't have choices. I mean, we want people to be able to make decisions, and that means having access to different decisions that they could make. And for many of the people I interviewed, they really didn't feel like there was a good choice to make. They had to make the best choice out of options, none of which were good for them, you know, or ideal, I should say, not good, ideal for them. And that's the reality of our lives, you know, and I think that that's true of so many things. I mean, I was just talking with my co-host on my podcast about divorce and like the stigma around divorce, which I think is much different than it has been. But, you know, for a long time, it was like, well, I never want to get divorced. People don't think they're going to get divorced when they get married. And then, oh, my God, I need a divorce. Like, and then it becomes a blessing, right, that the divorce is available. I think there's something very similar to abortion care. Like most people do not think that they will ever be in a position of needing an abortion until they do. And then it becomes a very, very different reality. And so I think addressing it from the reality that 1 in 3 people who can get pregnant will have, or 1 in 4 people who can get pregnant in their lifetime will have an abortion, that's the place to start, not in the abstract talking points.
So in your conversations with these people, what is the real harm that abortion stigma has? And this is primarily, even if you happen to have a political position of pro-choice, this whole posture of like, oh, I'm so sorry, or oh, that's so horrible, whatever that posture is, how is that harmful in the very real lives of these people who are having to make, very, well, complicated choices?
Yeah, I would say the way I'll respond to that is specifically around relationships where people felt so isolated, even if they had supportive partners, supportive families, supportive communities. Abortion stigma keeps us from learning how to talk about these issues, how to talk about abortion in compassionate, nuanced ways with people. And so we're very unpracticed. And I often talk about, like, as a white person, when I started talking about my own whiteness, I didn't know how to do that. I'd never done it before. And so it was very clunky and I made a lot of mistakes. However, like, the more I practice, the more comfortable I become, the better I am at talking about it. And I think the same is true when it comes to abortion, that we don't really know, many of us do not have the language to support someone through that experience. We don't know what to say. We don't know what support to offer. And so a lot of everybody I talked to, no matter their situation, felt isolated. In the experience, before the experience, in the experience, and afterward. And many of them still do, which I think is why a lot of them wanted to share their stories. And in the most extreme cases, you know, people's families don't know that they had this, and I had to change their names because they didn't want their family members to find out. So I think at that real, like, intimate level, it's that people feel like they are the only ones going through this, even though this is such a common thing for so many people. They feel like they are completely alone.
Yeah. That level of stigma and ignorance and all sorts of other layers of complication make the very real life of a complicated, difficult, challenging choice even more difficult and challenging with that isolation, because it is only through community and connection with other people that we can actually begin to make healthier and better choices for us. I want to go back to what you mentioned about the racism and classism and sexism. That's really key here. On page 16, because intersectionality is a big theme of this work that you do. Page 16, nowhere within their anti-abortion framework is a recognition that their framework, meaning the pro-life framework. Nowhere in their anti-abortion framework is a recognition of the hundreds of years of reproductive oppression of Black women through slavery, forced sterilization, mass incarceration, and other forms of reproductive control sanctioned and practiced by the state. Can you share a little bit more about how that intersects with the modern conversation of, you know, whether or not we should legalize abortion, et cetera?
Right. I mean, this was something that I really had to learn and study as a white person doing this work, which is what does institutionalized racism do to Black folks, non-white bodies in this country? And what has that looked like? And I'll lift up a very specific book because it does such a good job of looking at the history of this, which is Killing the Black Body by Dorothy Roberts. It's a classic text that really starts from the times of slavery, where Black bodies have been treated as commodities, including their ability to reproduce. And when those bodies were no longer a commodity, then there was a repression of their ability to make reproductive decisions. And I'll give a small example. She talks a lot about how in drug sentencing, for example, oftentimes if a Black woman was charged with a drug crime, she would be required to get a long-term acting contraceptive as part of her sentencing. And that's reproductive oppression. And we could also talk about the history of forced sterilization. They call it the Mississippi appendectomy, where Black women were just they just had their tubes tied without or hysterectomies without their consent. I think Fannie Lou Hamer was one who talked about that. So there's this whole history of not just the ability to terminate a pregnancy, but the ability to determine if, when, and how many children to have and how to care for them. Which is a foundation to the reproductive justice movement founded by Black women and Indigenous women in this country who were speaking to the pro-choice movement and saying, look, white women, you're not addressing all of our concerns. You know, it's not just enough to advocate for legal abortion. We have to make sure that we also can have healthy births and parent the way that we choose to. I mean, that's still a huge issue in this country. Black maternal mortality is three times that of white women. Like, why is that? You know, we have to look at all of the systemic oppression and how it intersects so that people can thrive in their reproductive lives.
So this next question, if you're willing to go there to kind of the core philosophical dilemma, I feel like that's connected to what you just said a little bit, because the core philosophical dilemma is the pro-life side is going to say life begins at conception, no ifs, ands, or buts. And if you care about life, then this is what you're going to care about, and you're going to put your stake in the ground, and everything else collapses around it. How does your posture with all of this, you know, complex nuance that is not welcome in the conversation, but you're trying to add this complex nuance to it, how does that interact with that driving point that's so persistent and prominent in the conversation?
You know, I think folks who hold that stance are probably not going to engage with me. And I think there are a lot of people who do see a more nuanced perspective, like people who have experienced miscarriage, I think have a very different understanding of this. Like, they all have different experiences of what that pregnancy means. I also love to talk about like end of life, because I think there's a lot of connection here when we talk about, you know, folks as they're dying, we often sense that they're like that their spirit isn't in their body anymore. There's a lot of mystery around this. I feel like the mysteries around when life begins are the questions that people have asked for thousands of years. What is life? When does it begin? How does it end? Where do we go? I mean, look at any ancient culture. This is all they're talking about. And I think there is so much hubris in us as human beings to determine huge mysterious questions that are connected to the divine in this way. And I think we have to allow ourselves like the mystery around these things and then tend to the very practical needs that people have, which is, regardless of what you think, someone who does not want to be pregnant or whose pregnancy is causing them physical harm, what are we going to do for them? How are we going to make sure that they're okay? I mean, that is who Jesus was. He tended to the real bodies and lives of the people he interacted with. And I think we just got to get a lot more practical about how we respond to you know, the real people that we live in community with, just as we would want our physical health and well-being cared for, right? I mean, this just feels so fundamental. I even struggle with why I have to argue this point, because it just seems so basic as a Christian. If we look at the model of who Jesus was, like, sure, he had debates, right? He had philosophical debates, but he also made sure to center the person in need of care. And I feel like that's what I'm called to do, you know, in this lifetime, is care for people.
Can I just say how much I loved your answer to my very insensitive question? Because at the very top of the conversation, I quoted you as saying, I am no longer interested in circular conversations regarding the moral absolutes of abortion. And I violated the very principle that you wrote about. And you gave such a wonderful, gracious answer to that, which I think is a good model. I'm kind of glad that we did that, because I think what you just provided is a good model for how to have a positive response rather than a very kind of, contemptuous response to those conversations. So I appreciate that very, very much. Okay. That's
maybe I've evolved. Maybe I can step back in a little bit after some time away. We're always evolving. I didn't mind it at all. And it didn't feel circular, you know, in the conversation that we're having. But yeah, I mean, I recently, and this is maybe a little bit of a tangent, but not really, I'm very interested in the concept of the soul and really exploring what that means, both within the text, but also just through people's stories about this. Because if we believe the soul is immortal, like, do we really believe that the soul begins when there's conception? Like, or was the soul already with God? I see from the text that the soul is eternal, timeless.
Are we going to spend the next 3 hours having a metaphysical conversation and debate around the soul now, Katie? Is this what we're going to do? Because I'm all in. I'm ready.
Okay, let's do that again, because honestly, I'm fascinated. I think this is so fascinating.
Yeah. Well, ensoulment is part of the religious conversation, and there is significant debate amongst religious and theological scholars regarding that, and even whether or not ensoulment is the right idea. So I think you're definitely touching on things that are very relevant. So we are going to have another conversation about that eventually. I would like to shift to some of the more practical elements, because there's a couple things here that you write about that I don't think are very well known and understood that we'd like to make more public. First is the unsubstantiated claims about the negative emotional and psychological impacts of abortion. You talk about various studies, and including one called the Turnaway Study, and to recognize that the rhetoric on one side of this political spectrum will often cite and use phraseologies, quote-unquote scientific studies, etc., to suggest that there is profound negative harm for the people who have abortions, for women who have abortions. So let's talk about the unsubstantiated claims, is what you say, and what is the Turnaway Study?
Okay, so we'll tackle the premise of the Turnaway Study, which is this manufactured idea that abortion is harmful to people emotionally. And in the 1970s, there was a syndrome created by crisis pregnancy centers, which, if we don't know what those are health centers that don't provide the full spectrum of reproductive health care, but are intended to, you know, have people continue their pregnancies. So they've got a stake in the game, for sure. They invented this term called post-abortion syndrome. And I talk about one particular dude in the book who has managed to amass a lot of literature around this. He's not a social scientist, but he's created like this massive amount of research that indicates that there are negative consequences for people emotionally in having an abortion. And it's so prolific that people just started repeating this stuff all the way up to the Supreme Court, even though the American Psychological Association has never substantiated this. There's no causation that anyone can find between abortion and you know, a mental health issue. certainly, I'm not saying that people don't have negative experiences, but there's nothing that has proven that this is an actual syndrome. And so it's kind of the pseudo-scientific speak that you will find in pretty much every anti-abortion book that I could find talks about this. Is like, not only is it killing a life, but you're going to be damaged if you get one. So it's a very common belief that, you know, abortion hurts women is how they say it. And so the Turnaway study actually followed people for 10 years, half of whom were not able to get an abortion when they wanted one, and the others who were. And they followed their like emotional journeys through that time. And I think it was after about 5 years, they found that pretty much all of them, regardless of whether or not they'd had an abortion, they had integrated the experience and were pretty neutral about it. But in the immediate aftermath of having an abortion, people were relieved. That was their overwhelming emotion. And the people who were denied an abortion felt an increase in stress, which honestly makes a lot of sense because now they're trying to figure out what they're going to do. And so, but it's a scientific study, again, like over a long period of time, with lots and lots of people, just to demonstrate that like they could not find any negative consequences for people. A lot of times what causes mental issues are all the stressors that are connected to an unintended pregnancy that someone wants to end. Usually they're like in a bad relationship, or they don't have a well-paying job, or they don't have a safe place to live. Like all of the systemic things that we were talking about before, those are the things that ultimately, you know, cause issues for people. And the abortion might bring them to the surface, but it's not the cause.
Yeah. Well, in many ways, the abortion stigma can add to that as well, because part of what happens is we find ourselves in difficult and complicated circumstances and situations. We are trying to pursue life-giving avenues for us. And if a particular avenue that is going to be helpful for us, for our life, for our well-being, et cetera, is stigmatized, then that adds social and cultural negativity on top of that. And that can very much add. This is why your book and your work is, I think, so critical, because it is a complicated choice. And I appreciate how much you recognize that there can be negative experiences through abortion. This particular question and line of inquiry is to tackle the claim of a scientifically valid syndrome of what happens with people. I want to make sure I get this nuance correct, because
You're right.
This is what you are saying in your work. It's okay to grieve. It's okay to say this was bad. It's okay to say that I had a difficult time. It's okay to have these emotions while at the same time not essentially taking that and weaponizing those emotions for a grand political endeavor, which I feel like is what is happening, what you're trying to call out here. So
That's right. And that oftentimes, you know, this is true of any emotion, especially negative ones, that we attach stories to what they mean. Emotions are things we experience in our bodies. We're trying to understand, why am I sad? Why am I mad? And sometimes the stories we tell ourselves are not true. They're not necessarily facts. And I think what has happened is the pro-life movement has manufactured social stories that then even people who feel very resolved in their decision to have an abortion start to have complicated feelings. And then they have a narrative to attach to that feeling. And you'll start to hear people say, like, is God going to punish me? Did I kill my baby? Those are not stories that came from within themselves. Those were manufactured stories that they then connected to their feelings. And I think what we have not done, I'm talking about like Christians in general, we haven't created spaces for people to simply process these feelings and have someone say, what you are feeling is a human feeling. You had a very human experience, and it is normal to have all kinds of feelings about it. And that doesn't make it bad. It doesn't mean it was wrong. It means that you're having some feelings because this was a big decision, and that's okay. And these emotions are going to move through you, and we're here to help you hold them. That's what we have failed to do. And in the vacuum of that, many of those folks find these anti-abortion or pro-life ministries that do offer community, but they also come with the negative stories that I was just articulating. And so we see like how, and then those folks become the anti-abortion spokespeople that you see out in front of the Supreme Court. That's how it happens.
That's really fascinating. The way in which we narrativize and story apply stories to our experiences has, yeah, it's interesting because it has that kind of double-edged sword effect. It can be incredibly healing. You mentioned that many of these women come away from the Turnaway study after a long-term period with an integration, like you have an understanding and you can tell a story about that experience of your life that is healing and hopeful and fully integrated into your worldview and your understanding and identity, etc. But then I never thought about what you just mentioned about the stories from the pro-life movement being turned into advocacy. I'm so sorry. I don't think I'm fully grasping the trajectory of there, but I'm really fascinated when you say that these are the people that become the spokespeople. Help me understand. Please forgive me if I'm asking you to repeat.
No, that's okay.
Take me there.
I tend to skip over words and things, and my brain works very fast. So sometimes I do need to slow down and break it down a little bit more. So I probably jumped there a few times.
That's okay. Well, that's why I'm going to ask.
Okay, no, great. So I can share specifically an example of how this works. And I talk about it in the book, which is there is an organization called Project Rachel that is funded by Priests for Life in the Catholic Church. And what Project Rachel does is it says that they are, you know, for anyone who has experienced an abortion, this is a community for you. If you're feeling sad, if you are feeling grief, come to Project Rachel. And it is community for them. And it is a space for people to maybe share about their abortion experiences. However, the agenda of Project Rachel is also connected to Priests for Life, which is an advocacy group that has advocated for anti-abortion legislation for a really long time. And so my hypothesis or my suspicion, and not even suspicion, I know that this is true because I've looked into it, is that participants who come to Project Rachel looking for care, and by the way, there are no trained therapists at these things, even though they claim their therapy, there are not trained therapists at these events. They come, they share their stories. They're then given the theology of what they did was wrong and how to repent from that. And part of that repentance work is sharing your abortion story publicly, right? As an act of repentance. And having come from an evangelical community, I can attest to this is the model that I saw in my own life with various things, is that you stand publicly and you admit what you did wrong. And so a lot of times you see the see someone holding a sign, I regret my abortion. Those are connected to Priests for Life that also funds Project Rachel. And so the way that I talk about it in the book is that they are preying upon the emotional vulnerability of people in the immediate aftermath, or maybe just the aftermath of an abortion, who are having feelings, who maybe cannot access mental health care because our mental health care system is terrible and inaccessible. They offer community, but then also push for them to become anti-abortion advocates. And that is how I see it working. I'm sure not all of them do that, but there are enough that becomes part of their repentance, part of their ministry, is to say to every other person, don't have an abortion, look at what it did to my life.
Yeah.
Very powerful.
Thank you for being patient with my stumbling over the question. That example, I think, was incredibly helpful. It's taking a fundamental fundamental Christian idea and practice of penance and repentance and, you know, confession, which can be wonderful and healing and restorative. And it's utilizing that, or I don't know, should I say weaponizing? I don't know if that's the right word. And utilizing that for, the advocacy work. And it can be incredibly powerful and meaningful, but then it just perpetuates the same cycle. That's really fascinating. You write, I wanted to make sure we got to reproductive coercion that you write about in your book. On page 67, you mention, you write this, denying young people confidential, dignified, and comprehensive reproductive health care is reproductive oppression. Coercion of any kind, even if supposedly done in the best interest of a young person, is a violation of their human rights and the divine right that we each have to make moral decisions about our lives. You're now suggesting that some of the laws that are being passed and some of the legislation that is being advanced requiring parental permissions, et cetera, is actually very, very harmful, which I think is, you know, really important to point out, given that the pro-life advocacy side is going to say that abortion is harmful and negative and has psychological impacts. Well, these legislations also have harm, not in the best interest of young people, as you say. So explain how and why that is the case.
Well, I'm not alone in this. The American Pediatrics Association has said the same thing about these restrictive laws for minors specifically. And it's not hard to figure out why. If you think about, you know, I mean, I have an 8-year-old, and I would hope that she would feel like she could come to me if she needed an abortion or anything. And she lives in a securely attached family structure with resources, and we would happily give our consent to her getting healthcare. However, there are many kids for whom that is just not their experience. You know, oftentimes they come from families where they don't have good relationships with their parents, or in some cases, the people I interviewed, one parent lives in another state, like the parents aren't together. And for them, it becomes even more of a dangerous situation, because not only do they not have the support of their parents to get the care itself, but then they can't go to them for financial care or financial support. So these kids are actually having to navigate the legal system on their own without support. I mean, there are organizations that do that, but you think about what we're asking young people to do who are already in a situation where they need help. And now we're asking them to navigate not only the medical system, but also the legal system by themselves, because the only way that minors can get an abortion without parental consent in these states is to go through the court system, which also delays their care. And when we're looking at the laws now, it's basically just making abortion inaccessible for young people, period. And I consider compulsory continued pregnancy to be reproductive coercion. Hmm. Being pregnant when you don't want to be is a form of reproductive coercion.
Right. And so the legislation that is attempting to delay is itself an oppressive piece of legislation in this.
Absolutely.
How involved is RCRC with lobbying work or that kind of those kind of efforts? Or is this more educational and cultural?
Where we are now, I mean, there have been a lot of iterations of the organization over 50 years. Where we feel like we can be most useful now really is in educating and giving skills to people of faith who want to be involved in this work, because we know now that so many of us are going to be called to take action in terms of just helping people get care, because it's become so much more of a maze, just like it was in the pre-Roe time, even worse in terms of the restriction. So we want to make sure that people of faith can have these kinds of conversations, can understand the rise of white Christian nationalism to where we got, and then how we're going to get ourselves out of this. And in the meantime, how do you provide that much needed care to people, you know, right now who are in crisis? Mm-hmm. So that's a majority of the work that we do. And we also work with the next generation. We have youth and seminary students that we work with to make sure, because they're really the ones most impacted by what's going on. And also they're the ones leading the fight. And so we want to make sure that we're investing in young people who care about this and want to talk about it from their faith perspectives, too. That's actually how I got connected to RCRC when I was a younger person, was through their youth program. And so we know that, you know, it's really important to invest in the next generations who are coming up, because they're going to be the ones carrying this fight forward, you know, after those of us are done.
I'm kind of curious, with that kind of posture and work, are you seeing a cultural shift specifically within religious communities and Christian communities? I'm kind of curious. I mean, we are 1 year now away from the Dobbs decision. We've just gotten news that over-the-counter birth control is going to now be made available. Things are shifting and changing. So things are going in seemingly two polar opposite directions at the same time. Yeah. So it's pretty wild. Given the cultural shifts that have happened, I'm kind of curious, what are you seeing within the Christian church and within multi-faiths as well? Because I know you work with other religions as well. What's the shifts and trends that are happening?
I see a lot. So let me try to focus on just a few. I mean, I think anecdotally, what we saw was a huge uptick in interest and outrage and people paying attention to what was going on. And that, especially once the leaked Supreme Court decision in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization came out in May. I think a lot of people were really shocked, even though those of us who have been doing this work, we knew that this was going to happen. I mean, this has been what the pro-life movement has been working, the white Christian nationalist movement has been working for 50 years. So it was no surprise to us, but a surprise to a lot of people. And so I think we immediately had, you know, so many more people coming to our website, contacting us, asking what they could do. You know, so I think there's a renewed interest. And I think that the abortion stigma is less of a concern for people. And folks are saying, I must do something about this, you know, regardless of all of like my, I maybe was reticent to in the past, but now I have to, I feel compelled to speak out. And so we see a lot more visibility of people who are willing and faith communities who are willing to step up in this area and do something. So, you know, I've just been invited to lots of churches who never would have invited me before to speak, you know, things like that, where people, there's just an openness and a focus, which I think is true of any justice movement. When there's a big moment, people pay attention and you have to, and take that, the possibilities around that, and run with them and see how do we get people into the movement for the long term, because this is a hard issue to be involved in long term. So I just see in general an interest. There are faith communities who are doing the work of getting people from one state to another, just that real practical support. I see people doing financial support. I see people doing, and on the other side, I see, well, not other related. I see a lot of Jewish folks and others who are saying this law is against my religious freedom, because restricting abortion access for me as a Jew is against my religion. My religion compels me to get an abortion in certain circumstances. And so, you know, this is a violation of my religious freedom. So we see religious freedom being talked about in different ways. It's been weaponized so much against minority religions. And I think minority religions are saying, wait a second, this also protects me, and you cannot pass a law that impedes upon my ability to live into my religious values. So I also see just people, you know, using that as a way, and we'll see how successful it will be at the state level. But that's another way that I've seen religious communities really step up, is to talk about religious freedom, protecting all of us. It shouldn't be a weapon. Yeah. It should be protective.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's an intersection of two competing ideologies, the religious freedom ideology and the ideology of protecting life and all that kind of stuff. So that's fascinating. Do you find any more Christians are globbing on to or finding that argument persuasive, both personally, philosophically, as well as publicly and culturally?
In terms of hearing a Jewish perspective?
Yeah, finding that Jewish perspective of this is actually my religious conviction of being, having the freedom to make whatever reproductive choices I need to make. I'm kind of curious if that's influencing more Christians.
Yeah, I think, well, at least the Christians I talk to when I go through the text, like there's really not a lot textual here for us theologically to look at. Mm. There's nothing textual that says life begins at conception. That is a theological, that is a modern day theological idea. It is not anywhere in the text that you can, you know, point to, even though people claim that there is, there's just not. And so I think more Christians are realizing, wow, there are nuances in the text, because the idea of life beginning at first breath, that's in Genesis. And that's part of our tradition too. And so I think there's, I think a lot of people just never really thought about this stuff before. I think there's more of a curiosity in going, okay, like let me, maybe I've identified as politically pro-choice. I haven't really ever been active on this. And now I'm actually having to wrestle with what I actually feel and believe about this. And so I think that there's an opening there around just exploring these concepts in a different way and saying like, hey, you know what? You don't speak for me, Christian A over here. Like you can have your theological belief, but it does not compel me to share it. You know, we have theological differences on everything within Christianity. I mean, I used to be United Methodist, and they say this is the denomination of Rush Limbaugh and Hillary Clinton. Like they're both United Methodists. So obviously there's a spectrum. And I think that that's part of the pushback, is it's not just Jewish folks saying this isn't my religious belief, but Christians saying it's not my religious belief either.
Yeah. Very, very nice. I want to respect your time because I know you have limited time today. I want to end on the vision that you articulate towards the end, getting close there. If we want to create a world in which every positive pregnancy test is cause for celebration, we have to ask what that would require of us collectively in terms of resource allocation, systems of support, and spiritual leadership. So in 5 minutes, sum up, what are those systems of support, the spiritual leadership, and the resource allocations that are needed? And that, I think, if we can just say, the idea that every positive pregnancy test is a cause for celebration, I love statements like that. Things that, regardless of your political position, can we all get together on this, right? So I kind of want you to share a little bit about your, if you have any more thoughts and perspectives on what that means to you and the work that you're doing. And then, yeah, sum up for us, what should we actually be doing regarding systems of support, spiritual leadership, resources, et cetera?
Well, the positive pregnancy test vision is not perfect. It's not a perfect statement. However, I think it gets us closer if we think about what that might mean, because I didn't want to say that every pregnancy is planned, because there are lots of unplanned pregnancies that cause people lots of celebration. And so I wanted to say, you know, no matter what, that it's cause for celebration. And that means that there's not fear. It's not a fear response or a, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? It's joy. And that means that there are systems in place to make sure that people, you know, have access to the healthcare that they need throughout their pregnancy, that they have the social supports in terms of affordable childcare and flexible work environments, that, you know, gosh, we don't even have paid parental leave in this country. We're like one of two countries in the world that doesn't have it. It means that, you know, people have jobs that are well paying where they can care for their families. Right. It's having safe schools, safe neighborhoods. I mean, it's really everything. It's everything that we need as human beings to flourish. Access to clean water, access to, you know, a safe environment where we're not having like extreme heat or droughts or right. Like it's a very intersectional statement when you break it down, in terms of it means that the idea of bringing a new generation into this world is not fear-based, but you're excited about what they might find. And I can't think of anything more beautiful than that. As a parent myself, you know, I want my child to have a beautiful world that she gets to grow up in.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's get on it. And the first thing to do is to support the work that you're doing at the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. And you end the book by saying compassion is not the same as agreement. The goal is not to be right. The goal is to be open. And Katie, you've been incredibly open and generous with your time. And I'm so appreciative of your work. I want to just reiterate a couple things. I like to do these little summaries in my head just to make sure that I've got everything going on. There is a long-standing abortion stigma that exists within our culture that comes from this political fight and ideology. And that stigma, as well as the culture that surrounds it, is harmful for women who are attempting to navigate complicated and difficult situations and circumstances. And regardless of your political posture, regardless of what you believe philosophically, I suppose, we should all be together and one on trying to fashion a vision of the world that does promote the very best of life in all of what life can offer for us. Is that a fair summation of what it is that you are attempting to do? And to educate people away from the harmful views and stories and negative narratives that prevent us from realizing that vision. Is that a fair summation? Is there anything you want to add to that?
That was beautifully summarized. And I just think judgment is what gives us the illusion of separation. Mm. And compassion reminds us that there is no separation between us. So the more we can tackle our judgments, the more that we live into the reality, which is we are all in community together. Mm. And the vision of the world that I have is contingent upon us remembering that truth, that we really are in this together. We are one, you know, and there's nothing more biblical than that.
Oh, man. There it is. Friends, the Reverend Katie Zay, author of Women Rise Up and author of A Complicated Choice, the CEO of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. Man, God bless you and all of the work that you're doing. And we hope that this conversation is helpful for those who are able to participate in it so that we can truly make space for all of it, the full breadth of humanity in this very complicated and vitriolic and contemptuous argument that we're having. And thank you for the work that you're doing to advance a very, very different kind of posture and position in the world. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
This was a life-giving conversation. So thank you so much.
Life-giving conversations are what we are aiming for. So I'm so glad that you have felt that and experienced that. Thank you everybody that joined us and for listening in, and join us next time for our next conversation. Have a wonderful rest of your day and night.